Hello!
Hey guys, it's Arden Cho.
Hey, I'm Holland Roden.
Hello, this is Ian Bowen.
Hey you guys, this is Melissa Poncio.
Hi, I'm Lyndon Ashby.
Hi, I'm Dylan Sprayberry.
This is Megan Tandy.
This is Tyler Posey, and you are listening to Not Another.
Not Another.
Not Another.
This is Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast.
Yes, it is!
Oh.
Woo!
Hey, this is Jeff Davis. You're listening to Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast, my favorite podcast in the world.
Welcome to Not Another Teen Wolf podcast. We are bringing you a very special exclusive interview for the season 5 premiere of Teen Wolf. Today, me and Karen are joined by the one and only Teen Wolf showrunner, Jeff Davis, finally. Hello, everyone. How are you all today? Karen, are you excited to be here?
I'm fantastic.
Yeah? Good. Jeff, hi.
Hi. How are you?
How are you? We're really good. You're finally here with us, which is really, really great of you to have offered yourself up for this experience, and hopefully it won't be too painful.
It'd be my pleasure, and it's about time.
For those who aren't super aware of, you know, the, I guess, legitimacy of this podcast, we've been running it for several years now, because I feel like we might get a few people listening to this interview that maybe haven't listened to the show before. And we have been running the podcast for a few years now, nearly 3 years, I would say, since the start of season 3A, or the summer before 3A, and we've recapped every episode of Teen Wolf, many, many hours worth of podcasting. And right from the start, MTV and the folks at Teen Wolf Production have been very supportive of our endeavors and very kind to us with everything that they've offered in terms of, you know, opportunities to see the set and, you know, organizing interviews and just having a good relationship with us as fan creators, which is really unusual for a show, especially with such a massive fan base, because there's so many people to go through and sort of choose from. But Jeff, as well, has always been incredibly kind about our show and about our website, and it's all been very intense and overwhelming, but we've developed somewhat of a friendship with the Teen Wolf production team via him over those 3 years. And so the first thing we would want to do is really say, first of all, like, why, but also thank you a lot for, thank you so much for supporting what we do. You know, it's very easy for creators and showrunners and official people to be not so into fan stuff because either it conflicts with their vision or because there's too much drama and things like that. So first of all, thank you very much for supporting us.
Well, I have to say that you guys are pretty amazing, and we wouldn't reach out unless we felt that we could talk to you and have a good time doing it. And also, I think you guys have been incredibly supportive of the show. It's sort of an amazing thing to be able to have a relationship with fans. TV was, when I was growing up, TV was just so completely disconnected. If you wanted to talk mm-hmm. about it with other people, you basically hope that other people were into it at school or at work.
Yeah.
And now with social media, you can talk to so many people about it. And I've heard so many people say that that friendships have been created across thousands of miles. Isn't that how you guys met?
Yeah, I mean, Karen and I didn't know each other that well when we started the podcast. We were just the only two people on Hypeable watching the show. Basically, it was kind of when it was like end of season 2, it was kind of like everyone was just kind of realizing that it was a thing, and we didn't cover it yet. And then Karen and I were both into it and no one else does. But now, like, a lot of people on the site watch it, but we didn't know each other very well. And then we kind of made a joke about starting the podcast together because everyone else had podcasts and we were the only people that liked Teen Wolf when we wanted to. And now we talk literally every day for many hours. and we've gone together to places for fun. And it's really, it's quite a lot, isn't it, Karen?
Yeah, it is. And it's amazing to think that, you know, Teen Wolf was the one that brought somebody from New York and somebody from Australia together, and now we're so close. And it's just amazing what things like that can do.
I love stories like that.
So we're gonna get into the interview. First of all, as well, I'll tell you guys where you can reach us if you have any feedback for the interview or just for our podcast in general, or if you want to talk about season 5. You can always reach us on our Twitter, which is natwpodcast. You can email us natwpodcast@gmail.com. Our Instagram's going to be seeing some action this summer because I'm going to be at events and Karen's going to be at events and some of the other girls are going to be at events doing Teen Wolfie related things. So natwpodcast on Instagram. And you can also join us on Tumblr, which is notanotherteamwolfpodcast.tumblr.com, or just notanotherteamwolfpodcast.com for the main site, which is our incredibly active Tumblr where we try to blog all of the best fan creations and theories and posts, as well as trying to answer a lot of queries from fans that get sent to us because they think that we work for you guys or something. So it's fine. We don't mind. But a lot of people have been a little bit confused about whether we are officially part of the show. We are not, but we try to be objective and answer those questions. The girls who do the Tumblr spend a massive amount of energy trying to keep that all nice and informed and civil. So yeah, that's where you can find us if you want to. Karen, this is your party. Why don't you take it away?
Okay. So first question, because we heard from one writer, Alyssa Clark, that Jeff, you had no idea that needles were such a big thing and that it grossed so many people out. This was, I believe, last season. Yeah, that's what Alyssa said.
Well, I knew they grossed Colton out. I knew that he had a certain fear of needles. That's why in season 2, the needle going into Colton's neck is actually my neck.
Right.
They did a take of it, and when I came onto set, I was told that the needle went into Colton's back, and I said, "What? That's not how it should be." And they said he would faint if he did anything else. And it's not actually a needle. So I said, "All right, give me the wardrobe." And so that's my neck taking the needle from ice.
How do they do that out of curiosity? I know Karen has more to this question in terms of the medical stuff, but how do they do that? Like, for example, in the premiere, like injecting into Lydia's arm, and like, how do you do the fake needle coming in and out of skin?
It's usually a plungible needle, which means the needle itself doesn't have a point and it just retracts back. It's like one of those fake knives. For the needle actually going into the skin in the premiere episode, that's a fake arm. So, that's done by our makeup effects boys, Chris and Eric, who do a phenomenal job for us. It looks pretty disgusting though, doesn't it?
It does.
Yes. Yeah, really a lot.
But I knew that people would faint at needles, but I didn't know. Alyssa has a tendency to exaggerate. I did not know that so many people were just absolutely horrified by needles. Probably because as a kid, I had many, many shots due to my own asthma and having to go into the hospital and get IVs of prednisone and things like that for severe asthma attacks. So you're all a bunch of rips.
So the main question here is, what made you decide to focus on these creepy doctors for season 5?
I've had a real fascination with this kind of steampunk aesthetic, and I have a sort of a fear of hospitals and doctors myself, having been to the hospital plenty of times, the emergency room plenty of times as a kid. But I just liked the idea of combining science and the supernatural. When we're doing a show like this, there's always the fear that we're going to get locked into a storyline where some werewolf is trapped in a cage and somebody's taking blood samples out of them. And I've always said I don't want to get into test tubes and things like that with experiments on werewolves. But then when we came up with the Dread Doctors, it was a way to do it that was still sort of within our same creepy supernatural aesthetic. So masks and very tall, strange, powerful villains. I think it fits within our world, which has become quite expansive.
Yeah, the thing I've always I sort of noticed about the Teen Wolf world, or at least my interpretation of it, is that it seems a lot of the stuff that's supernatural seems less like magic, like, oh, dragons exist now, and more like advanced biology. Like, I found it really interesting, for example, even I think last season that, you know, the illness that you chose to give to the werewolves was like weaponized distemper, like a dog disease, and also Scott being able to sense Erica's seizure with her epilepsy, like way back in season two, which is also another like dog thing. And so I've always found the kind of slight biological aspect interesting. And then now that we've got all of this like science and experimentation of like, you know, what are they trying to do? It's just making, you know, making me think about sort of the advanced potential, you know, advancements in biology. And so I think going into science actually makes a lot of sense to me with this universe.
Yeah, I love stuff like that. And it's an idea of where do science and the supernatural converge. And Alyssa actually came up with a lot of those great ideas. We kind of miss her in the writer's room because of that. Mm. And although she's at the office now, she's editing episode 10
yeah.
for us.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to have her back. But it's a way for us to do it differently than other shows. We're always trying to figure out how can we do it our way.
Yeah, that seems to be important because there is a lot of supernatural sort of canon out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Next big question is obviously, you know, the opening scene which was released from the episode, and then the, you know, obviously carrying on into the episode, was Lydia in Icon House, and potentially towards the end of the season or after the events of the season from what we've worked out. But we see her basically breaking out of her catatonic state or pretend catatonic state. We can't quite work out which one it was yet. And basically fighting her way out, like enhanced with the Banshee powers, being able to add a bit of a physical element to that, both with actual fighting and with the kind of powers projecting people away.
Yes.
When can we expect to learn sort of how she did that, or if it was even real or all happening in her head?
I can tell you it's all definitely real. It's not
okay.
happening.
Okay, good.
Head.
That's a start.
And one of the reasons it's happening is because this was the season where we said, okay, I think it's time for Lydia to start kicking some ass. We love the character. We love Holland and how she plays it and how the character has evolved. So we felt it was time to amp up those powers and amp up the tension with her. I think the details of it will be probably not come out as quickly as you'd want, but that's how we are. Always gotta make you wait. So the one thing I can tell you though is this is the season where Lydia decides that she needs to become a fighter. That's to be able to learn how to protect herself.
We certainly have talked about that at length on the podcast, now that everyone is choosing to be in the fold, you know, what they have to basically physically protect themselves from scenarios that they might get into. So, and we still sort of weren't expecting it this, even though we've talked about it a lot of times.
I think it's a great evolution for the character too. One of the things we like to do at the start of every season is just list a bunch of ideas of what would we like to see. What are the scenes we want to see as writers? I remember when we were sitting there thinking about it and saying to ourselves, I want to see the Banshee power come out this time. We want to see Lydia kick ass. And Holland was so up for it. She was so excited to do it. She actually does a lot of that stuff herself. She's got some good training. And she's very
like
physical.
Like martial arts and all of that.
She's got some stunt training. She got some stage combat. So cool. After when we shot it that night, we were all looking at the monitors and we kind of all looked at each other and said, more fighting for Lydia.
I agree. My one tiny, possibly confirmed question, if you can, and if you can't, you can just laugh at me, is whether something we were debating on the recap episode was whether basically whether that horrible nurse was horrible and correct or whether she was horrible and wrong, whether Lydia was faking that whole thing and it was a plan to get out, or whether that kind of stuff came out of her as a defense mechanism and the catatonia was real.
She was definitely faking.
Okay,
for the full story, you're going to have to wait a little bit to see what is the entire story of Lydia in Icon House and how she gets there.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yes. That's
but I will tell you that the reason she gets there is it's not a fake. So she winds up in Eichenhaus for very difficult psychological reasons.
Real reasons. But that particular scene, even when they injected her and everything, she was faking being in that state.
At that point, she's a prisoner.
Okay. Interesting. Oh, cool.
Speaking of Eichenhaus, and this has to do with the terrible, terrible orderlies that always seem to work there.
Everyone is horrible.
Yeah, they are. Does Eichenhaus make people go crazy, or do the crazy people just sort of flock to it?
I think they probably gravitate to it, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, I've got a really good job opening for you. You want a job where you can be like a total, like, terrible human being? You know, apply at Eichenhaus. Like, yeah.
Yeah, we've imagined it. This is our version of Arkham Asylum. And we always loved these kind of classic sort of horror places where nothing good ever happens and no one's ever going to leave this place healed. So it's not a happy place.
Yeah, it's quite nasty and horrid, yes. And hopefully the people in Beacon Hills who do need genuine mental health treatment end up getting a better option. Yeah. The next thing I was really excited by in the premiere was actually seeing Malia with her adopted dad. We call him Bear Trap Dad, but yeah, Mr. Tate, basically.
Todd Stashwick, a great guy.
Yes. Yeah. We were very excited not just to see him back, but what it means to see him back in terms of her, I guess, her choice, like, you know, to be, you know, with the family that raised her and, you know, how she feels about them as her family members, because the last season we sort of didn't really see, we saw a lot of her finding out about her birth parents, but we didn't know whether she just like lived in the woods and climbed into Stiles's bedroom, whether she'd gone back to live with, you know, her father and she really considered him her father, you know, adopted, and what kind of message that sent about, you know, adoption versus biological parents. So basically we're just excited to see that and what inspired that identity, the family identity thing. Obviously she has that moment at the end as well where she's kind of like, am I a Hale, am I a Tate? And that was beautiful, like that whole scene was amazing. But what made you choose to inject that back in?
It's all a sense of identity. I think it's all these kids growing into adults and choosing who they want to be as adults, and they're getting into their senior year, and Malia has chosen she wants to be a Tate. She wants to be like her adopted family, who are good people. She's going to have more trouble this season with accepting or figuring out who her biological mother is. So we wanted to bring back Tate to remind the audience and to remind her as well that there are good people in her life. And also it's a way to bring back Todd, who's a great guy and a very good actor, I think. I mean, they've got him locked up on the sci-fi show 12 Monkeys. So
Yeah,
we're trying to get him back for more on Teen Wolf. So cool. It's hard.
But yeah, so she's living with him as like she went back to live with him out of the woods. And, you know, he's got his daughter back, which is nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I loved his little bit of playfulness with her as well, like scaring the boys and then winking at her. I really loved that whole scene. So, yeah, it was really great that he's there. And I was just glad that whole issue with Malia got basically not settled, obviously, but that it is sort of confirmed in a way. But yeah.
Yeah, it's our love too of proud and strong single parents as well.
True.
I come from a single parent family. My mother took care of three boys for many years until my stepfather came into the picture. But it's a way to show that these kind of non-nuclear families can be great too.
Yeah. Cool.
Now, my next question is very superficial, but very, very important.
Go for it.
Who had the brilliant idea of giving Kira a sword belt?
That was my idea. And yes. I had it in season 4, and we had decided it would be too expensive, but I even drew it. I said, I want it to look exactly like this. And they all said to me, well, if we put the holes in the sword, then it's not going to we think it'll break and we think it'll be dangerous. And I said, I want it to look exactly like this. Make it look that. And they did it. And I love it. It is so cool.
Oh, man.
comes out like that, I think it's, it was very happy, a very happy moment to see that on screen.
It was amazing and so unexpected. Like, you think, okay, how is she going to defend herself? And all of a sudden she whips this thing out and it's like, oh yeah, that's how.
That is not a superficial question at all. That was a big, huge deal to me to get this
one. And the stupidest thing is when she was standing on top of the car, I was just like, such a cool outfit with the chunky belt and the shorts and the tights and the sneakers. And I was like totally like digging her outfit and I was still not prepared for the sword belt. How much of that?
So glad you guys like it.
How much is like CGI versus like physical? Like, you know, like how is it all CGI'd or is there an item that actually kind of does that?
Well, we made it, we made the belt. We have several versions of the sword, but for the sword to whip out and be, to solidify into a piece like that, is CG. And the first time they showed it to me, I was like, wow, that's fantastic. So it's absolutely worth it to me. And it just makes her cool, you know? It's just cool.
Yeah. In your head, did she make it herself? Or, like, where does one obtain that as a 16-year-old kitsune?
No, we have an actual very specific idea for this that we've been trying to fit into the episodes, but I can tell you as a slight spoiler, you guys, that Yukimura, her father, Ken, is a weapons maker.
And cool.
It's the one who fashioned the obsidian into her tail. So
That's cool. Cool.
We're trying to bring an element of that in this season. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
I like that. So FYI, the entire senior scribe scene, I'm not talking about like from the punch at the end. I'm talking about like from the view into the library from the outside in the rain. I was like sobbing. Just so you know, I was like hardcore crying. I think the first thing that set me off is that your library looks exactly like my high school library. Exactly.
Really?
Like same lighting tone, big arch window with those two stairwells going up around like a center hall. Exactly the same. And when I saw the first picture, I like freaked out. And then I saw this and then I sort of saw what they were doing. And then I was crying. I was crying at all the initials. It was like really bad. But anyway, the point is, how important is it for you to keep sort of Allison as a presence in the show through small gestures like that scene? Also, where did that, like, was Senior Scribe a thing at your school? We've never heard of it before. Did you make that up for the show?
Yeah, we made it up. We wanted them to do some kind of ritual, and I liked this thought of their initials. Our first idea was that they would do the initials on the big rock out at Lookout Point, which is one of our sort of sets that we come back to, locations we come back to a lot. Mm-hmm. But and we actually heard that there was a high school that did that, that their names and stuff on it. But once we saw the library set finished, we thought, what if it's the same shelf that they have all the yearbooks on, and each year they go at midnight right before the start of school, and they put their names down. So that's something we entirely came up with. It's amazing to me, like, how emotional this scene came out. And if you look at each character, there gets their moment.
Oh my God, so much. Those close up shots is just like Malia's like told a whole story. Like it told everything. Yes. That you'd been wondering about the character for 6 months. And it's just like, but all of them, like Styles as well, like just everyone. And we were asking all these questions about, you know, about what it would have been like for Derek, or if it was just like someone else's random initials that just made him think of Derek, or like all of these kind of things. But I was just sobbing, probably like top three scenes in Teen Wolf for me and crying. Like Victoria's death was really bad, but this was like, both times I watched the episode, it was the same amount of crying both times as well. So thanks. But yeah,
I have to say, it's something for me personally as the writer who created that character, and then to acknowledge it and to say sort of like to say in my own way and even to the fans that I miss that character. But it's also to more importantly, I think it's an homage to the character for the fans, and also to Crystal Reed, who did such a brilliant job of creating that character in the way that an actor brings life to a character and surprises you. I just love the look on Tyler Posey really killed it in that scene for me. I remember sitting in the first edit, seeing that scene and sitting up and saying, oh my God, it's there. It's all on his face. Look at his face. I think it really nails it. And people have told me that they all burst into tears in that scene. So it's very gratifying.
Yeah, because we were talking about the difference as well between a character dying, like, oh, a character's died on screen, it's very sad. But not that many shows do a fantastic job of not just like being like, hey, remember Allison? She died. But portraying the idea that the characters are living with the grief, if you know what I mean. Like, it's not actually that easy to do. So, yeah, we really love that, basically.
Great. That's
okay. We've been debating about this next one for quite a few days, and we cannot work it out. Hopefully you can tell us. Is that Dr. Valak interrogating Lydia at the end?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Justified.
To me, the actor looked different. We could not work it out because at the time when we were recording, it wasn't up on IMDb, like who the full cast for the episode were, and it was, and we just didn't. It didn't look like the same guy. He obviously didn't have the hair. He's no longer a prisoner. He's a doctor in Icon House. He's not a prisoner. And we were very confused and couldn't quite face match with the Doc Valak actor if it was the same guy or not.
That's a situation of the inmates taking over the asylum. So,
oh my God!
Have to wait a little longer to see.
That's a spoiler.
See just how he's managed to do that. Yeah.
Oh no. Oh God! If they've taken over the asylum, I dare not even ask what that means for Peter Hale being locked in there.
Look up if you want to know a little more about him. Look up he's named specifically, but look up the demon Valak, V-A-L-A-C. So.
Oh, cool! Yeah. We will do that.
Our names, we often choose our names carefully with double meanings. So.
Interesting. Cool. Yeah. Karen, how's that making you feel?
I feel so happy right now just because I was like, I have this like face blindness thing. So I can look at, you know, the same person in two different episodes and not necessarily realize they're the same person. It's terrible when you're trying to write articles and you're like, I don't know if this is the same guy doing this. But I was like, no, I'm pretty sure it's him. It makes so much sense. And I have so many theories going through my head right now, but they're all very spoilery, so I will save them.
All right. We'll do a follow-up.
That would be nice. Yeah. One of the things that I was curious about was which actors or characters can we expect to see the most sort of unexpected things from this season, or who's really going to either impress us or show something different. In the premiere, the first one that really struck me as different, not in a good or bad way, well, kind of in a bad way, I guess, was the sheriff and his kind of attitude and what's going on with him. We were a little bit confused about, you know, why he was, you know, anxious about Parrish, whether it was a protective thing or whether he didn't trust him as a supernatural creature. But just in general, who's going to have some really different stuff from what they have had before?
Yeah, I can tell you Stilinski is, he's caught. He's caught between the world of the law and the supernatural. And he is struggling with how to be a sheriff and how to protect supernatural creatures as well, and keep that side of the things going on in Beacon Hill secret. So he's going to really struggle with that, and Stiles is going to come to that struggle as well. I think I'm really happy with the performances this season, and we struggled. We really tried to give everyone some interesting things to do this season, and I got to tell you that Scott and Stiles, Tyler Posey and Dylan O'Brien, they have some great scenes together this season. There's some really emotional stuff. We wanted to really test their relationship, and those two are so good together. And they really, I think they really enjoyed playing off each other. I have to say that some of our new characters really surprised me. I think Cody Christian is going to surprise a lot of people. Some of his stuff is just fantastic, and we were so happy to have him. It was really quite a pleasant surprise to see just how much, just how well he came into the cast and the show and fit with everyone. And the cast loves him too.
Yeah.
So I think we're gonna have a lot of fun with him. But I also say that Kylan we gave Kylan a much bigger part this season too. We wanted to bring up Liam and Mason's friendship as well. They're kind of like, we sort of consider them Scott and Styles 2.0, but it's a little different because they each have traits that are similar to Scott and Styles, but then opposites as well. Scott is becoming more zen this season and very in control of himself, while Liam still struggles with anger and with all the rage inside of him that makes becoming a werewolf very difficult. Mason is kind of like Styles in that he's completely supportive of his best friend and excited by things, but incredibly smart. But whereas Styles is kind of a cynical pessimist, Mason is always optimistic. Mason is always the bright side. So
yeah, I really enjoyed Liam in the premiere, like not so much more than I was expecting, but like, you know, he's only been around for a short time and obviously he's going to be a regular this season, but we kind of after you've been watching the show for four seasons, sort of the newer characters, you sort of forget how much of a presence they have if you're sort of still imagining the show in a certain way. And he was just so good in the premiere and I loved it so much. And I love I almost just said something out loud that was something we say on the podcast, but maybe I shouldn't say to you.
Tell me now.
Well, now that Scott is zen, I call him Hot Dominatrix Dad Scott. and I love Hot Dominatrix Dad Scott. So that is I love that entire tone, and it's so interesting to see Tyler like that because it's like nothing like his actual personality. It's such a credit to, you know, the craft of acting that like the air about him is totally different. But Liam, I loved in the premiere, so I'm excited for that. And yeah, just basically everyone really. But yeah, Theo, we're all very curious about whether he's good or evil. He's giving everyone some sexy eyes and it's all very intense. And yeah, Karen, you sort of are determined that he is untrustworthy and evil at this present moment, are you not?
Yeah, I don't like him. And, you know, maybe that'll change. And if it changes, you know, that's just good storytelling. But Styles doesn't trust him, and I've learned to always trust Styles. So I don't like him.
Well, that gets handled in the second episode.
That'll be really soon then.
Where the quote of, because you trust everyone, comes from.
Yeah. Yeah, which we've had some chat about already for sure. So yeah, that should be fun.
Okay, so I guess final season 5 specific question would be, what other things can you tease us about for the rest of the season? What other things can we expect?
I hate giving away teases, but let's see. I will say that all of the relationships go through some rough times, including, well, you already see it in 501, Selinsky and Melissa. They butt heads on something in particular. I'm very excited for some of our guest actors, like Kelsey Chow, Michael Johnston, and others who bring a really cool dynamic to the show. And a lot of threat as well.
I guess the final scene of the first episode with Lydia and, you know, her interrogation and those memories of, you know, Melissa and Stalinsky and, you know, Styles and Malia and all of those kind of things. Are you able to tell us, are those real? Are those flash forward, like, footage from real episodes, or are they things that could happen or that she's hallucinating?
They are all real. And they will
all. So those things all occur in the show.
Yeah. Mm. I think only one doesn't occur in season 5A. So you'll have to wait for 5B for one of them.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right. We were going to go on to a couple of questions. We just had one question each about sort of a reflection on a past season, and then one question each about a big unanswered question about the show, which you may or may not be able to tell us. And then we'll be almost done, I think. But that's it. Shall I go first with this one? Because yours is a bit more general, Karen.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mine was actually reflecting back to season 4 and Derek. Obviously, Derek is not going to be around so much this season, and we've sort of come to terms with that. But Derek in season 4, we see a lot more of who he is as a person as opposed to as like a werewolf or whatever, both with, you know, his de-aging to what his personality was like before he went through all that trauma, and also, you know, his kind of very calm, you know, slightly sarcastic, funny, grumpy, but not like traumatized self. When he was, you know, losing his powers and just sort of hanging out in his building, not being an alpha anymore. I'm curious about when you first created the character, did you have in mind like who he was as a person without the immediate angst and baggage and anger that he was carrying? Or was it like something that he grew into, you know, as you were writing? Like, did you know what his base personality was like when you introduced him as this sort of angst monster?
Yeah, we knew that he had been very much changed by the fire and by losing his whole family. We had originally, I developed the pilot with Rene Echeverria, who we sort of like batted around a ton of ideas, him and Michael Thorne and I. And we had seen it kind of like, we'd seen him kind of like Michael in The Lost Boys. Wait, no, not Michael. Wait, which one was Kiefer Sutherland? Kiefer Sutherland in The Lost Boys. God, I can't remember his name.
I've only seen this movie once as an angry teenager, so I cannot help you there.
But we always saw him like Kiefer Sutherland, and he was expected to be a bad guy. But that's when the actors sort of really change your mind about things. And
yeah.
I mean, he was just – he's just so good. Yeah, Michael was Jason Patrick in that. It was David. That's what his name is, David. So those things change along the way. Everything changes. It's in the writer's room. You come up with ideas that you love, and then you toss them out. And then you come up with ideas that you absolutely didn't expect. The great example of that is Holland, who she's an actor that you want to write for. So you keep coming up with new ideas, and new writers come in a new season, and they've got all sorts of different perspectives on the characters that you hadn't thought of. That's why I like bringing in new writers every year, even if it's just a staff writer added to the show. Mm-hmm. So the original idea was that he was going to be a bad guy and maybe not even last more than a season. But I think he's just – Hecklin was so charismatic as Derek, and it was fun to write that role and fun to see him. And also the relationship with Styles. I mean, that kind of love-hate relationship between them. There are things that you see on screen where they have such good back and forth – such good rapport and banter that you keep wanting to write for that. So that's how things like the pool scene in season 2 came about, because they were so good together in season 1. But and that's also why we miss him this season. He won't be part of 5A, but we are still keeping the door open for 5B. Kind of depends on schedule. Now, the thing with actors is you tell them you want to have them in 3 or 4 episodes, and then you have to deal with their agents who tell you they're only available 1 week in the month of July or August. So I could talk on about that, but MTV would not want me to.
Good luck with that. I mean, we've come up with a few theories for you about how you could include Derek. Like, you could hire the wolf and have him sitting in the corner and have people like, what do you think of that, Derek? And he could be like, and you could have some hilarious comedic moments. This is
Wolf
a
is the best actor to deal with. I'll tell you a story about the Wolf and Derek. Actually, is we had this whole scene created about how Derek sort of communes with his mother as the Wolf in the dream. You remember this scene and communicates with her. One of the problems was the Wolf wouldn't play serious, unfortunately. And the wolf had its tongue hanging out the entire halftime. So when we watched it in the edit, we kind of watched it with our hands over our faces, thinking,
and
oh,
it
God.
It did not have enough gravitas.
And I was sitting there thinking, why doesn't the wolf close its mouth? So we have actually, if you watch that scene again, you could actually see how we CGI'd out the tongue, because it just was ridiculous. Actually, I'm looking at the TV Guide issue with us on the cover. Hold on one sec. I think the wolf's tongue is hanging out in the picture with Derek. I gotta look at it. Yes, the tongue is out. It looks like it's waiting for a snack.
That would be great if that wouldn't matter if it was Derek in a pack meeting. He could totally have his tongue hanging out, and it would be a great comedic moment. Again, these are just some great ideas I have for you. No, that's that. We'd welcome him back, obviously, in any form. But yeah, I was just curious about obviously his actual personality sort of coming out to play in season four. It was really nice and really validating, I think, because it was the kind of the personality that a lot of people, you know, kind of imagined for him, given the layers of the performance that Tyler Hoechlin gave.
Absolutely. He's one of the he's the character, I believe, in the show that changes the most, actually.
Yeah,
we really said that. He really does start as a dark guy who is ready to kill anyone. And he comes to believe, he goes through the hubris and failure of an alpha who shouldn't have been an alpha. And he accepts his place and becomes a better hero for it. He was evolving. And Hoechlin was really happy. We talked a lot about it, and he loved the whole changing into a wolf thing. I think he was also happy that we left the door open for him to return. Yeah. I don't think he had told me he was ready to move on, but we try to keep things open. I've been talking to another actor about coming back to the show. I'm not going to tell you who, and we're trying to fit that actor into possible episode arcs.
Time for Isaac. Sorry. This is an ongoing joke that we have. Sorry. But very exciting, whoever it is. We had an article Karen wrote theorizing about all the people that could come back when we got the spoiler that there would be a familiar face, which ended up being Max, which was obviously a lot of fun. But
there's a work in progress for more, so I'm very hopeful for more. So
cool. We're always happy about that. Anyone pretty much would be very exciting.
Like, it's devastating when your favorite characters on a show die. I'm still mourning the loss of Jon Snow.
I have some questions about that. Like, I've read the books, and I feel like that they've left it, like, in a very weird place in the show. But anyway, we're not going to talk about Game of Thrones, because that's a stressful situation. We might talk about another show in a little bit, but let's see. Karen, what was your reflecting question?
Yeah, so I was just wondering if there are any unanswered questions, or I guess more in particular, any unexplored ideas from earlier seasons that you'd like to sort of revisit that you didn't have time to do before and you'd like to incorporate in the future?
You know, I'd love to. It's hard to talk about this because it can be a bit of a sore issue for me, but I still would love to finish out the character of Jackson, you know?
Yeah.
It was hard with that whole thing that happened with Colton leaving the show, but we had so many ideas, you know? And I think that was probably my one big regret, not being able to finish out that story. But it happens. It's a tough business. And when you think about it, when you look at it, you realize that it's not just we're getting together and telling stories. It is a business with a lot of money at stake for a lot of people. So and unfortunately that creeps into it and affects it. So unfortunately some of the creative gets affected by the business side when you'd rather it not.
Yeah, that's true. Like, I woke up my morning, and I was very incredibly shocked about the news about Hannibal, because it felt like it had one of the biggest presences on the internet. But the reality of that versus the business side of advertising and viewers and all kind of stuff. And
that's one of the reasons we're very lucky.
Really shocking. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the issue of ratings these days, because Hannibal does do incredibly well on DVR, does do very well downloads, but it's not hitting the number that NBC needs for their advertisers, for their commercials. Yeah. And everybody knows these days that Nielsen ratings don't tell you how many people watch the show. They tell you how many people watch commercials. And NBC is still entirely dependent on commercials, whereas the cable channel, which is where Hannibal should be, is dependent on both commercials and subscribers.
So
Hannibal could easily live on cable. And I'm hoping, because I'm friends with Brian Fuller, who's an amazing, awesome guy, I'm very hopeful that it'll find a home on cable or Netflix. I love that show as well.
Yeah, that was just something that sort of surprised me a couple of hours before we started recording, and so it's on my mind. But okay, so we wanted to do as well a biggest unanswered question of the whole show. Each of us, you know, because we could probably throw things at you all day, being like, what was this? What was this? What was this? We're not going to do that because we don't want you to hate us. But we're each going to give ourselves amnesty to ask one big unanswered question that we've always wondered about. It might be stuff that you have no answer for. It might be stuff that you can't tell us. It might be stuff that you'd be like, why do you care about that? But we're going to do it, so hopefully that's fine.
Go for it.
Mine is, what did Peter's bite actually do to Lydia? Because for a long time, you know, all we knew, she was immune to the bite and it didn't work. Then her banshee powers activated. But was that like a coincidence or an age thing? Like age 16, you become the banshee? Or did it need the supernatural activation of Peter's bite? Like, what was the actual connection between her banshee powers and his bite?
We as writers have always felt that it was Peter's bite that triggered it. And it's when he says to her, I'm the spark that lit your fire. So he's basically saying to her, you wouldn't be a banshee without me. And that is, it's sort of, it's an odd relationship because he is a villain. He's an evil person. The bite was a violent attack, but she got something out of it, though, which can be a hard thing to deal with. And that goes to the idea that people who suffer tragedies or suffer pain, what do they get from it or what do they learn from it?
Would if she still developed those powers? Because if those powers were hereditary and they, like, would have that come out in another way at some point, or did it need some sort of, like, trauma to bring it out?
I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe we should write that down in the writer's room.
Yeah. I've just always been curious because once we found out about her grandmother as well, and then she also kind of had an emotional trauma that brought stuff out, but she already knew slight things. So I was just curious about, like, if you have supernatural genes, does it need like an activation or do they just come out eventually, basically?
Well, it is kind of interesting that in these stories, it's somehow it's traumas that bring it out, right?
Yeah.
So I wonder about that.
Yeah.
All right, what's next? Yes.
Okay, my turn. Mine's going to be the one where you ask, why do you even care about that? But I'm going to ask it anyway. So how much did Mr. Harris actually know about what was going on in Beacon Hills, and how involved was he? Because this has always been this huge unanswered question for me, and I really was sad to see him die. I know he was sort of a jerk, but I wanted to learn so much more about him.
You know, I was sad to see him die as well. And it wasn't my idea, but I went with it because I wanted it to be a bit more oblique. But the way it was filmed, I remember watching the cut and saying, well, okay, I guess he's dead. but he was definitely involved and knew a whole lot. One of the things I liked about that character the most, though, was that if you asked him, how much do you really hate Styles? He wouldn't say that he did. He would say that he was Styles' best teacher. You know, I think we've all had teachers like that who are brutal to us and think that they're doing it for our own good. So I miss him on the show. I miss that kind of tough teacher. We have a character like that this season, though, who will become a bit of a pain in the ass to Scott. So you'll have to wait for that. But my feeling was that he was definitely involved with Jennifer Blake and was bargaining with her for his own life.
Mm.
Not a good person.
Because we also got, I can't remember if this was, I'm sure this was part of the show, that he was also involved in some way with Kate Argent. Like that, you know, that he was what, this like non-supernatural, like, go-to guy? Like, what did he get out of the whole situation? Like, power? Like, did he get anything in return? Like, oh, Mr. Harris. But I don't know. It was, like Karen said, it was always a confusing and curious character, this kind of, how many of these human being, like, you know, lackeys for the supernatural world are there running around?
I'm sure there are plenty. Yeah.
Is Danny one of them?
It's like how the Nazis brought many people in to do their dirty work.
Mm. So. Nice.
Right.
Okay. So we then had a couple of questions as well. I think that we're just about ready to be finished, actually. Karen, do you want to do yours?
So, of course, fans are always worried about, you know, when is the show going to end? And, you know, like we just saw with Hannibal, sometimes those things kind of come out of the blue. Do you ever, when you set out to write each season, do you kind of have it aimed to end so that if that does end up happening, it's kind of a clean end? Or do you not really factor that in?
I try to tell the network to give me some warning. It's interesting right now because nobody seems to want it to end, which sounds exhausting to me. But we'll see.
11 seasons of Teen Wolf.
I know. It's the business is changing so much right now, and they're seeing the big term now is the aggregate number of viewers, and so who knows? I always say as long as we have stories to tell, we'll probably keep going. But
College Wolf.
But we'll see. College Wolf, yes. I don't know. I kind of feel like these kinds of shows do best when it's maybe 5 or 6 seasons and then they're done. You know, there's a certain point where you start telling the same story. But finish before we've worn out our welcome.
I think there'll always be an audience, but I do understand what you mean, especially when the show has the same vision the whole time rather than just like scrambling to keep going just because someone said they could, basically. So yeah, like I think that some shows have really got painful because they are no longer care about trying. So I think that's probably the most important thing. My last question is sort of just a bit of a fun one, kind of, which is if you could swap for one episode or an arc with another showrunner for you to write or direct for them and them to write or direct for Teen Wolf, who would you swap with?
Oh, my gosh. Geez,
it could be a friend or it could be like someone that you just like admire from afar.
I would love to write an episode of Hannibal. and I love Brian Fuller. God, what else? Walking Dead, maybe.
You'd have to trust them with Teen Wolf as well, so they might kill off everyone.
And very true. God, I would love to see a Brian Fuller Teen Wolf episode. That would be extraordinary. Probably an incredibly beautiful episode. But that would have to be my answer. Hannibal.
Brian Fuller, Hannibal. I slightly suspected that you might say that, but but yeah, good to get a confirmation. Cool. Yeah, Karen, I think that was all of our questions that we have for today. Obviously, we could ask you endless questions forever about random things like, you know, in episode 3.2, why did this happen? But we've promised ourselves that we wouldn't do that to you. So yeah, Karen, is there anything you wanted to say before we let the man go do his real job?
Just thank you so, so much for coming on. It means a lot to us, and I really hope our listeners enjoyed the episode.
Thank you both. You're amazing. I love the podcast. I love your website. You guys are so good to us. Really. I can't thank you enough. And
thank
I would love
you.
To do this again. So have me in for another one.
Absolutely.
We will hold you to that if you are not busy. Thank you very much. And yeah, we'll see you soon. I think both of us will see you relatively soon, and
awesome.
We'll all be reporting on you guys at Comic-Con. So we'll say bye. Everyone can say bye to Jeff, and thank you for coming and talking to us about the show, and hopefully we'll have a really great season 5. So bye.
Bye.
Bye.